Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema. Who are these guys?
Get ready to rock, Junkions, because it's time for another episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
Dot com.
You're never too old if it's not too loud. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, lieutenant of Megaforce, he is the best keytar player that I know, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
And I'm still crazy.
After all this time. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast, where the pursuit of wisdom is a low priority. Let's just put it that way. In the words of the great Billy Connolly, how did you get this number? Please stop calling here. I'm super excited that we are continuing on with our theme of guys who rock. A follow-up to last February's Gals Who Rock. And last week, of course, we talked about Velvet Goldmine. And this week, we're talking about a film that actually shares a lot of interesting thematic content with Velvet Goldmine. However, there is no Jedi Master fornicating with a Dark Knight of Gotham.
There's not a lot of Wang in this movie.
Not as much as you would expect. But hey, speaking of Wang...
Chung.
Thank you. I was like, this is a terrible segue, I know, but our back catalog is available on iTunes, as well as on Blog Talk Radio and Spotify.
That is the worst segue.
Yeah.
That's a segue that Scott Weinberg would pass up on.
It's a segue that you can't even take tours on in downtown Austin. That's how bad a segue it is. But our content is there. I can't do anything about that. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema.
It's the segue that got cut out of Paul Blart.
Oh, Jesus. You know what? Here I was thinking that we would never bring up Paul Blart Mall Cop on Junk Food Cinema, but you found a way.
Why wouldn't we?
Life finds a way to bring up Paul Blart Mall Cop.
I love saying the words Paul Blart Mall Cop, because it sounds like, if you say it loud enough, it sounds like something Gandalf says on the bridge of Thulsa Doon.
Wow, I just felt my virginity grow back. The what of the what now? What's happening?
No, I literally just dropped really bad gaffes in there. It's awesome. But think about it.
The bridge of Thulsa Doon.
No. It's not the bridge of Thulsa Doon. That was a joke. Thulsa Doon is the villain from Conan. Keep up, Brian.
I'm not nerdy enough to keep up with your intentional Lord of the Rings errors. Speak nerd and enter. That's not the point, guys. The point is, if you really like that...
If you really, for some reason, like my bullshit...
If you like David Lean's The Bridge Over the River Thulsa Doon, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. For as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. Backstage passes, you might call it, to all of the wonderful
Paul
extra...
Paul Blart Mall Cop! None shall pass!
Paul Blart Mall Cop sounds like something a first-year theater student says to warm up vocally before they give their monologue. I'm just saying.
Why are we talking about Paul Blart Mall Cop?
Because the Bridge of Thulsa Doon was already covered and we got to talk about
there
something.
We go.
Oh, hey, how about instead we talk about Still Crazy?
Well, there's only two reasons get you to haul your ass up here. Either I owe you money, or you want to put the band back together.
They were called Strange Fruit.
Strange Fruit. Been fruits a long time.
So, which fruit's which, then?
Well, I'm posh fruit.
And they were one of the greatest bands of the 70s.
Yeah, we hated each other in the end.
Oh, hate's a bit heavy.
That was then. This is now.
1, 2. Hello, Wembley.
Wow! It's Night of the Living Dead too.
Well, maybe we should agree what key it's in there.
B flat.
C.
G.
You can find yourself another singer.
Pretty pointless reunion.
This was our second shot.
Why couldn't you bury the past before it buried us?
But when the music still matters...
I want to stand in the dark and see an audience feel the way I do.
And the passion still burns...
I'm not 50!
You're never too old to rock and roll.
still crazy.
Sign this, please.
Sure, man. Best wishes to who?
I need a signature for the pizzas.
Let's do that.
Because this is a movie I thoroughly loved, and I'm happy that we get to talk about it.
And it's another movie you had no idea existed.
And I said this last week, but I'm gonna repeat it. These series, Gals Who Rock, Guys Who Rock, are almost 100% curated by Cargill. Because this is just not a genre that I have a lot of experience with. So, yeah, this is another movie that you recommended we do, and I was like, well, I've never seen it.
And that I really wanted to do together, because I love that last week we did the love letter to glam rock.
Yeah.
And then Still Crazy is about a bunch of glam rockers 20 years later, after glam rock is long dead, and they've been forgotten.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that both of these movies open with narration about history. Almost, it's crazy how much the lines of dialogue to open both movies. This is, of course, a monologue delivered by the great Billy Connolly.
Histories, like ancient ruins, are the fictions of empires.
History teaches us that men behave wisely once they've exhausted all other alternatives.
Yes, this is a movie in which Billy Connolly plays the road dog and historian of the strange fruits.
Oh, your ass didn't know? You better call somebody, because Billy Connolly is the road dog in this movie. And he has a quote, which I love so much. He says, "History teaches us that men behave wisely once they've exhausted all other alternatives. For most rock bands, the pursuit of wisdom's a low priority compared to fame, fortune, and fornication." So, like, I'm like, all right, I'm on board. I'm on the ride. Let's see where this goes. I'm super excited. And this is also a movie that has a lot of your favorite British actors in it.
Oh, God, yes.
I think the only movie that I can think of that has more great British actors is any given Harry Potter film.
Well, Love Actually. First of all, there are Harry Potter actors in this movie.
There are indeed.
All over the place. But I would say Love Actually is the one movie that is one Judi Dench short of every working person on the UK. Like, in fact, there are so many great actors in Love Actually that it's pretty much the Marvel roster at this point.
Sure. No, it's one dent short of Parliament, I think, is what's going on there. And also, just quick sidebar. How the hell did Billy Connolly not turn up in the Harry Potter movies as like a really rogue fucking auror or somebody who works in one of the departments at the Ministry of Magic that no one talks about because he's off his fucking rocker?
I imagine that when you call Billy Connolly and go, "Hey, would you like to be in a Harry Potter film?" you get a really inventive series of swears out of him.
Take your fucking Harry Potter and shove it up your arse.
For those of you that don't know Billy Connolly, you should. And everybody has their own inroads to Billy Connolly. I want to find out what yours is.
Oh, you know what mine is.
Mine is bizarre.
Okay. Well, let's start with yours, because you know what mine is already.
I don't.
No, I bet you can guess what mine is. I went to college. I'll put it to you this way. I went to college. I had posters for this movie on my college dorm, because I'm kind of a basic bitch when it comes to my college years of watching movies. Boondock Saints.
Well, there we go.
Come okay, on.
No, Boondock Saints is a great inroads. I didn't know if that was it or not.
That's my one. Yeah.
For me, Billy Connolly is the second person. He takes over on a sitcom called Head of the Class from Howard Hessman. Howard Hessman started this ABC sitcom called Head of the Class.
Old man Cargill, that old man Cargill.
He leaves, the entire rest of the cast stays, they get a new teacher, and that teacher is Billy Connolly, who, of course, at that point was a successful stand-up comedian, and would then go on to become a legendary stand-up comedian. He is probably, I would argue, the best way to describe him, he's the Patton Oswalt of the British Isles. just the creativity of his swearing, the wisdom of what he has to say, the greatness of his sense of humor, and how well he does showing up in bit parts everywhere, where whenever Billy Connolly shows up, like, oh my God, it's Billy Connolly. I love Billy Connolly. And this is no exception. Like, this is an oddball comedy with a bunch of great actors tethered by this great performance of Billy Connolly, just playing the narrator. Like, yeah, he's really just kind of in the background, and he's just kind of yucking it up, having a good time. So much so that once we stop talking about him right now, he's not coming up again, because literally he does not involve himself in the plot at all. He's just kind of around, and which is awesome.
Yes.
But the rest of the cast is kind of absurdly cool.
It really is. I mean, and I said this to Cargo when I showed up tonight to record, we as a society did not get enough Bill Nighy as an aging, confused rock star. We got two.
We got two great Bill Nighy aging rock star movies. I saw this when it came out in 98.
Yeah, both the movies we've covered so far are from 98.
And both are in love with glam rock from 25 years before.
And both involve, both have a plot device about a band member who may or may not be dead.
Also true.
So it's interesting. And both of those, by the way, both those characters have the same first name. There's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of weird parallels between last week's movie and this week's movie.
Yeah. So I saw this when it came out. So when I saw Love Actually, which I saw in a theater twice, for me, Bill Nighy's Billy Mack was that character from Strange Fruit. Like, I'm like, oh, it's the lead singer of Strange Fruit again. That's yes. Fucking awesome. And so I already had this headcanon history in my head for who Billy Mack was.
Sure. No, absolutely. And in this, Bill Nighy's playing Ray Sims, who is the lead singer of a band from the 70s called Strange Fruit. Their drummer is a guy named Beano Baggett, which, by the way, also sounds like a Lord of the Rings character. Like, you want to start shouting about...
Oh, yeah, that's a Hobbit if ever I've heard one.
Fucking shout at Thulsa Doom about that guy.
And it's Timothy Spall.
It's Timothy Spall, speaking of Harry Potter. But kind of our main character within the band that we're following is the keyboard player Tony Costello, played by Stephen Ray.
Who, of course, at this point, this was him slumming it. This was... He was doing a lot of big stuff. He was one of those actors who was all over the place. And he was doing this cutesy comedy that, by the way, I mentioned this last week, but this is important. At this point in history, every single British comedy was being marketed with the same fucking line. I swear to God, they were paying their execs, they were paying their ad people to scour through reviews to find the phrase, this year's Full Monty. Everybody wanted a movie like the Full Monty. And so there's a period of like 3 years where every poster of a British comedy says, this year's Full Monty.
God, how fucking big was that movie?
I was thinking about it earlier today. It was huge, and it's not a film that anybody talks about today or that has this huge impact. Like, it was a film you couldn't get away from in like 1997. And now it's like, it's not a thing. Like, there's so many other films from that era that when you talk about British comedies, you talk about a Boy, you talk about Love Actually, you know, those films, Full Monty isn't one that really, you know, you hear more people talk about Brassed Off more than you hear people talk about the Full Monty.
Yeah,
which is kind of weird.
I don't even know what that is.
Well, you know it because there's a famous line in it by the late great Pete Postlethwaite.
Oh, okay.
That is used in the opening of Chumbawamba's Tub Thumping.
Got it.
You hear it now, don't you?
No, I don't.
Not that it matters. Not that the music matters.
Yes, it doesn't bollocks next to our music matters. No, I get it. Dude, you said that, and I was like,
oh yeah, yeah.
That man, my fucking middle school years just came screaming back at me. Fucking Chumbawamba.
I get knocked down, but I get up again.
And then I put on my JNCO jeans. I get knocked down. That was a dark time for a lot of reasons.
It was a drinking song about getting fall down drunk that they used for every family film that was released for 2 years.
Jesus Christ. Every fucking romantic comedy that was like, here's the trailer and it's like record scratch, Chumbawamba. It's like, God, stop. Everybody fucking stop it. I loved it. Middle school Brian was all
that,
about it.
There was the period of time where it was that or it was Jump, Jive, and Wail by the Brian Setzer Orchestra.
She's got fucking sidebar.
All right, let's go to the sidebar.
Fuck, you know what? I, even as a sprat, the thing that I hated so much in the world was the brief resurgence of swing music and people taking swing lessons. And it's just like, what kind of fucking Benny Goodman, Django Reinhardt nightmare am I living in?
I really loved that time.
I was not in the mood for it. Let's just put it that way.
You were not in the mood, but you know what? We were. It was 96 and 97, and there was this whole resurgence of essentially what happened was grunge had died, and everybody was grasping at straws, and nobody knew what the next big thing was. And so for 2 years,
swing.
They literally threw everything at the wall to see if it would stick. And swing came back. It's where we got the Squirrel Nut Zippers on the radio regularly.
Oh, and Big Bad Voodoo Daddy.
Yeah, well, ska came back, and we got stuff like Big Bad Voodoo Daddy and the whole host of ska bands that came in. It's where they started playing the Prodigy on the radio. They started grasping at straws with all the weird indie rock. Like, it was a really, really weird time where the indie station was so fucking eclectic for like 2 years. It was every style of music all being played at once, and it was glorious. And then fucking bubblegum pop came back, and the big thing became Britney Spears and 98 Degrees and NSYNC and Backstreet Boys and Creed, and music died, and music crawled into its own ass and whimpered itself to death.
Ironically, do you know what band played at music's funeral? Creed.
With arms wide open,
can you take me higher? Yeah, I think we can. I think literally anyone can. Thank you very much, Scott Stapp Infection. We are done with you.
Give me that Christian side hug, crazy man.
Look, swing Heil all you want, Cargill, to bring Christian Bale back into this discussion again. But I'm starting to realize, in both terms of music and movies, the late 90s were like this big box store the size of an airplane hangar that had been ransacked on Black Friday. And then you go into the late 90s and it's literally just, now it looks like a flea market and we don't know what the hell we can buy.
That's very much what it is. Hollywood had completely broken down and indie film took over, and indie film was doing all the interesting stuff. Hollywood was trying to follow behind, going, we don't understand what you people want anymore. We gave you all the Arnold Schwarzenegger and Stallone films you wanted. And it was like, yeah, we wanted that 10 years ago. We want this stuff now. And so they started investing in all these crazy young directors who are doing crazy shit. And the same thing happened with music. Yeah, no, there is a window of time in the 90s when everything was just really cool and exciting for this small, narrow period of time. The beginning of the 90s is a fucking wasteland. And the end of the 90s became a fucking wasteland. But there's this sliver in between, starting in like late 90, summer of 92, when Nirvana and Red Hot Chili Peppers like really broke wide. And about late 97, when pop started really kind of coming in that window, there's all this great film and music that's just really amazing and defines that era. And then is just flanked on both sides by lameness. Now, some good stuff came out of it. We'll end up talking about summer of 99, late this summer. Cause that's where Hollywood started roaring back. Cause it started taking risks again and creating some really cool shit on its own. And we saw kind of the death of indie film as that happened. But yeah, this is it. There is that weird, everybody's like, we don't know what's cool, so let's just try to figure it out. And so they grasped at straws and we got some cool shit out of it.
You walk into 1997 saying, I would like a good movie and some good music. And the counter offer is Cherry Poppin' Daddies and the film adaptation of McHale's Navy.
Well, I mean, yeah, but it's also Jackie Brown and the Prodigy. I mean,
which sounds like a band in and of itself I would go see.
97 was Fat of the Land. And, you know, that was a really interesting year. And in terms of film, 97 is one of my favorite years. But let's get back to 98 and still crazy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Stargrove.
We forgot Stargrove. Stargrove.
Yeah, so still junk food after all these years. Come on, guys. What did you expect?
Still junk food after all these years.
So this is, as we said, it's a movie that follows the attempt to reunite a band called Strange Fruit, who at the beginning of the movie, we see them playing a gig in the 70s where they literally have their stage struck by lightning, and it serves as the last straw, and they break up.
Yeah, they were a band that was already on the skids. Essentially, what's set up is you've got, you know, the previous lead singer died of a drug overdose. His brother seems to be following him into the grave, who's the lead guitarist. They bring in a talented new guy to sing with the band, and that's the guy that everyone remembers as the singer of the band, but who never quite got along with the bassist because the bassist had given it a go as the lead singer for about a month and it just didn't take. And he felt that the new singer really didn't get the music that he and the old singer had been creating. And yeah, it created the perfect storm of when the perfect storm hits, that they just all fucked off and went their own separate ways for 20 years. And it didn't work out for any of them.
Right. And so after that happens, we see kind of where they all are now, and the keyboard player played by Stephen Ray is, he happens to run across the son of the guy who organized the music festival.
The Whiz Bang Music Festival.
So he runs across the son of the guy that organized that festival that was their last gig and realizes that they could potentially put something together again, and he proceeds to try and reunite the band, and they are kind of starting from scratch when they get back together playing these really kind of dirt clubs in Europe and in like Belgium and Holland and all these places. Here's what I liked about the movie immediately, is that I didn't know that the two tastes I wanted blended together were Spinal Tap and The World's End, but that was precisely what this movie felt like, and that bowled straight up the middle for me, because I love both of those movies. Because it is about the absurdity of being a band and playing these shit clubs and the weird fights and conversations. So that felt very much like This Is Spinal Tap. At the same time, the Stephen Ray character trying to reunite the band and relive the glory days and actually having to deceive them a little bit to get them all on board felt very much like Gary King, Simon Pegg's character from The World's End, trying to get all his buddies to go back to Newton Haven. And I actually appreciated, this is one thing I could have used more of in The World's End, was the blending of the contemporary storyline with flashbacks to when they were young and the band was big. I really liked seeing both sides of that.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really interesting the way it's written, such in a way that it makes sense getting all these old stories and seeing these brief little clips. Like the flashbacks are always like in these slow motion,
yeah,
kind of dreamy look backs at, here's, it's not, hey, go back and watch these guys act out a scene.
Right.
It's listening to our narrator explain to people at times, here's what happened, here's the beef between these guys, and us getting that glimpse of them in their glory when they're in their 20s and they're as hot as they're ever going to be. They're these gorgeous men fucking rocking out and just conquering the world. And then they go their separate ways and they're like, fuck you, I'm going to go be a star on my own. And then none of them are. And yeah, the way that's all woven together. And the fact that that's what's interesting about it. It's not a let's get the band back together movie in that, hey, let's find everybody and then go on the road and we're all going to be best friends again and the world's going to be against us. It's mm-hmm. like, no, they've got every opportunity and the world is all about them rocking. They can't get their shit together. They still have all those same old wounds and they all get reopened. And you see in the contemporary time exactly what happened 20 years before.
Yeah, and I think that I like that if you know, just have a very cursory knowledge of rock music, which I would say that I do, just a very limited knowledge of classic rock music, you start to see the analogs in the, I mean, very much like last week where it was like, obviously, Brian Slade is an analog for David Bowie. Characters like those played by Bill Nighy is an analog for somebody like David Lee Roth, who's brought in as the new singer, doesn't quite get along with the
Sammy
band.
Sammy Hagar.
Well, no, specifically David Lee Roth, because David Lee Roth, Sammy Hagar didn't gel with the sound, but David Lee Roth was the one that they like fucking came to blows with because they were just like, this fucking guy is all about himself, not about the band. They couldn't really take that. And there's so many other little things. Actually, the story about what happened to Keith in the movie, who is the brother of a character called Brian, very much reminded me of what happened to AC/DC. And when their lead singer died of a drug overdose, Bon Scott, and how Brian Johnson kind of had to take over the mantle of being the lead singer. And it's just, there's all these like little things that feel pseudo biographical to real bands, I thought was really, really interesting. But really, it's the rapport of this cast. When you have like Timothy Spall playing this just really scummy drummer who is just fucking great.
I love Bino. Bino is
so good.
The thing is, Bino's scummy. He's just kind of, I mean, he's just kind of white trash is the only way to put it. Like, he's just kind of this poor guy who just loved being a drummer and loved everything about it. And then kind of when it was over, just kind of went back home.
Well, I mean, in the opening scene, like, the opening scene, but the first time we see the contemporary version of Bino, he's working at a nursery for plants, and somebody very official looking comes up and asks if Bino Baggett works there. And he's like, oh no, he moved to Zimbabwe. And like, then somebody sticks their head out like, Bino, you got a call. And he's like, okay, cool. And just takes off running. Oh, yeah,
because the thing is, he's in debt. He's £33,000 in debt. Like, which he blames on bad management.
Yes.
Which is one of the nice, Bino is this loving, wonderful guy who every time you kind of bring up the things, he gets very upset very quickly. All right, bad management. Yeah. It's like Brian before he got married. Like, just, you'd be having a conversation and be like,
Yeah, no, that's, first of all, spot on. I mean, that's an incredible impression. But yeah, no, that's, God damn you. Yeah, so.
That's what you get for that Sinister 2 joke a few weeks ago.
Jesus Christ. Lannisters send their fucking regards. God damn, holding on to a crutch. I got to go back and even find that. Okay. Yeah. Best served cold, indeed.
Best served frozen solid.
Like a fucking Gorton's fish stick. What were we talking about? Timothy Spall.
Timothy Spall.
Spall Grove. Anyway, so yes, he's running from creditors when he kind of jumps in and then literally runs into Stephen Ray driving in the car and is like, we're trying to get the band back together. He's like, not a moment too soon, and just jumps in. So he's on board immediately. Bill Nye's character is living in a mansion and has a Norwegian woman that he's married who kind of runs his career now, and he's working on a, quote, solo album, and at first she doesn't want him involved, yada, yada. But it's just, once they're all back together and on the road, these guys, as comedians, as actors, gel the way that you would expect from bandmates. Like, there's a nice little correlation there.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's so great how the vibe of all these guys works together like they've been together. There's this great moment when they first get on the bus and Bino's getting his balls busted by Bill Nye. And he goes, you know, Bino, you're what we call a flatliner. There's zero growth. And Bino just goes, well, it's better than being a wanker.
Yeah.
And the way everybody else busts out laughing and humiliating Nye that way, in that moment, you feel the dynamic of the band. You feel these guys who have been through the shit together, and just that one shot back across the bow is enough to be like, oh fuck, I just got put in my place. And that maintains, and you watch, you know, there's a great moment where Bill Nye is bitching about how the band isn't coming together. People are bitching about his pipes, and he's like, well, I'd be doing a lot better if Bino weren't building a fucking shed back here.
Yeah.
And you see the sniping that happens. And having been a part of a group that was like that, you know, this close-knit group of people all working together, all with kind of, that had this brotherly rivalry, but, you know, brotherly connection, but also these rivalries and these various things. It really kind of captures that feel. It captures that, you know, the quick to anger about something that you shouldn't be quick to anger about, because God damn it, he said that 12 fucking times before and I've had enough of his fucking bullshit. And they do such a great job with it that when the movie kind of really takes off, and they get into their groove, it makes you happy.
Yeah, it really, man, that there's such a warmth in them starting to gel. Like, in a lot of ways, structurally, from that point, it is pretty boilerplate. Like, there is, you know, there's nothing really revelatory about it. I will say the one thing that I find very interesting is how they manage to squeeze a lot of heart out of these little moments that are in line with convention. Like, when they're all getting back together and they're like, all right, well, where is Brian? And it's like, well, we found out that all of his royalties have been going to this cancer foundation as a bequest. And they're like, oh, fuck, he's dead. So we have to hire a young guitar player to kind of take over for him. But the thing is, the manager that they bring back was a woman who was in love with Brian. So for her, a lot of the undertaking of doing this in the first place was to reconnect with this person that she now finds out is dead.
And to kind of finish up, you know, old unfinished business.
Sure.
Like, that's the other thing, is you see that she's really in this because she loved the band and she feels like the band didn't get the ending or the shot it really deserved, and that it deserves one more shot, one more go. So much so she pulls her kid out of school and her kid goes on the road as doing the job that she did when she was pretty much that age, when she was, you know, as they said, you were, the line is, you still had ink on your fingers from school when you came on board as the costumer. Yeah, as the costumer. Mm-hmm. And so she was the person who started out as this kind of tag along, who then ended up being the person in charge and kind of making sure everybody's shit was together. And you see, they never show that to you. They tell that to you. And then you just see it in the way everyone treats her. Like, nobody disrespects her. She is running the fucking show. And when she brings the hammer down, everybody just kind of shuts the fuck up. And it's really great in the way that that works. And then watching how that new guitarist then starts having a thing with, you know, the daughter.
Yeah.
And seeing her heartbreak over, you know, falling in love with a musician. Really well done. But you mentioned boilerplate. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about this movie, is this movie is a comfort film for me. Like, it's one of those films.
For sure.
This is not a film. Like, last week, you've never seen a film like Velvet Goldmine. This week, you've seen 12 movies like Still Crazy. This is just one of the better versions of this story.
Yeah, I mentioned two movies this feels like a mashup of. Do you know what we didn't say at any point last week? This feels like a combination of this and this. Because it doesn't. It doesn't really feel like anything at all.
But it is exactly what it sets out to be. It's a feel-good movie with great fucking actors doing a great fucking job. By a director, by the way, at the end of his career. Like, this was his last movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he was somebody that did some pretty epic stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. His name is Brian Gibson. And actually, what's fascinating is he was responsible for some really remarkable... for the music videos to some really remarkable songs, including Styx's Mr. Roboto.
Which is, by the way, not just a music video. He shot the video that played at the beginning of all the Styx shows,
yes.
Which you can find online. It's one of my favorite Friday night nostalgia dives. Is after my wife has gone to bed, I'll watch stuff like Night Flight and such like that. If I'm not watching Night Flight, usually I'll go and seek out a couple of things, specific things, and the opening video for Mr. Roboto is one of them, and that was done by him, in which they literally shot this 10-minute opening that would play at the beginning of all the Styx concerts. Let's take a quick sidebar here, because this is interesting history. So Styx was a band that was on top of the world. Things were going really well. And the lead singer had this crazy idea for a concept album. And he's like, they were a keyboard driven band.
Mm-hmm.
They had this very futuristic sound, and the lead singer wanted to do
Dennis.
I'm blanking on his
name.
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember his name.
Wanted to do this concept album about this story he had and his friend. And it merged together nostalgia with this Kilroy Was Here thing. You know, Kilroy Was Here was this famous meme in World War II, where World War II soldiers would draw this little famous face of this guy peeking over a wall, and it would say Kilroy Was Here. And so all over Europe, there's all this graffiti from where American soldiers was that says Kilroy Was Here. So he merges kind of this nostalgia for this 40-year-old meme with this future story about, freedom, you know, very 1984-ish, very freedom has been
very
banished.
Very Orwellian, yeah.
Very Orwellian. And it's about this guy who is a rock and roll singer who is convicted of murder, and he escapes prison by hiding in the body of a robot. And so the song, you know, Domo Arigato, Mr. Roboto, is literally him saying, thank you, robot, for being the body that allowed me to break out of prison and allowed me to be free. And the entire concept album is all about Kilroy breaking out and starting a revolution. The rest of the band didn't fucking get it.
Yeah.
And they didn't get it. And as a result, the album was a huge fucking success. But the band ended up breaking up over personal shit as a result. They completely dissolved because the band did not understand what this crazy fucking album was about. And they didn't understand why it was so successful. And so for Gibson, right? Brian Gibson?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To have been present for that and had directed the thing about that, to end his career then doing a movie about that same thing, I can't help but think that there's a lot of sticks in Strange Fruit.
For sure. Dennis DeYoung, by the way, was the name I couldn't come up with. Now, that's a very interesting point. And not only that, but to be among such personal strife of a band, of a band that had as big a reputation as Styx did, because to do something I will very, 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 very rarely do on the show, to quote an Adam Sandler movie, Styx is one of the great American rock bands and only didn't get their fair shake because most critics are cynical assholes.
Yeah, it's weird. The other thing that's important is that Styx would later then get back together to tour on a reunion tour. And it would never really catch.
So much in the same way that Velvet Goldmine is not really, but kind of David Bowie, the movie, this is not really, but kind of Styx, the movie.
I think I've never had that confirmed, but of course, Brian Gibson died in 2004. Mm-hmm. You know, this was the last movie he made. He also made Poltergeist 2, The Other Side.
And speaking of music biopics, What's Love Got to Do with It?
What's Love Got to Do with It? And then The Juror, speaking of 90s Hollywood not understanding what everybody else wanted.
Because it stars Alec Baldwin?
No.
I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. You set that up on its ear, like, yeah. Not understanding whatever. This is also at the same time that we were putting Alec Baldwin in superhero movies that I desperately love. So I can't talk shit about
Also true.
Also, and then you just turn it off and Tim Curry wins.
And, you know, in the middle of the 90s, all of a sudden, Billy Zane is smashing evil and nobody knows what the fuck is going on.
Slamming evil. God damn, I'm not doing this with you again.
Smash evil.
I'm going to make a note so that 6 episodes from now I can bring this fucker up again. Don't fucking do that again.
And slam evil, god damn it.
To be fair. I wasn't married when we did that episode. So.
No, in fact, we did that in your sex dungeon garage.
Look, my theater room garage, not my sex dungeon.
Call it what you want to call it.
You keep saying that motherfuckers are going to believe that. That is not a patron tier where you get to enter the sex dungeon, so don't even ask.
That's the $50 a month tier.
And the safe word is Fidelio. No, it's not.
Safe word is smash evil.
I'm not going to take debate. I'm not going to do it. Not here. We're not breaking up the band on this episode about Still Crazy. That's not what's going to happen. Fucking Stargrove. So, one thing I did want to mention before we get too off track, but then too late.
We've Stargroved the fuck out of this episode.
Seriously. We have Spallgroved all over this. Bill Nighy apparently was inches away from being in the movie Life Force, and I never knew this. And now I'm thinking about how great it would be if we had Steve Railsback, we had Patrick Stewart, and Bill Nighy in Life Force. Like, that movie would have been just that much more.
Who was he supposed to be?
He was, you know, the actor that beat him out was actually someone that I don't recognize. So I don't actually even remember the character. It wasn't Steve Railsback. It wasn't Patrick Stewart's role. It was an actor named Nicholas Ball playing Roger Darabridge. I don't remember who that is in the movie because it's not Patrick Stewart.
You know what?
Stewart.
We might be discussing that in a few months.
This is very
true. Life Force might actually be on the docket for a special event we have planned for April.
Yeah, a special event that I've already written a theme song for in my head, and it might be to the tune of a Toto song. I don't think that's going to give it away. I don't think that's a good enough clue.
You know what? I know what you're talking about, and I still can't put it the fuck together. I came up with a month, and I'm still like... Oh, wait, no, now I do.
There all it right. is, there yeah. it is. It's like you gotta track through your brain, like, how does a Salisbury joke work? Okay, now I understand it. Now I hear it in my head.
Damn it, it's an Africa song.
No, that's Soto. That's what it,
that Smash Evil
sounds like in my head. That's not. Yes, I am screaming. You know that meme, speaking of Kilroy, of like screaming internally? That's just me pretty much all the time. Just screaming screaming internally.
And when you do this show.
And when I do this show specifically. Still crazy.
Stargrove.
After all these episodes. So, yeah, so they go back on the road.
By the way, we haven't mentioned, this is actually named Still Crazy based upon the Paul Simon song.
Yes, which is why we keep referencing it. It is, and not only that, but there have been bands like the Fratellis that have actually borrowed from this movie to name like their album. So it's a movie that's based on a reference that becomes a reference for other things down the road.
Yeah.
Kind of in the cyclical nature of everybody referencing everything. But I think there's so much fun in watching these guys go on the road and just not really having their shit together. There's a great sequence where they're in a really small music hall and Bill Nighy keeps wanting the amps turned up and turned up and turned up. And Billy Connolly, who plays their old roadie, who comes back to go on the road with him, who has a great line about, the last gig I had was roadieing for Aerosmith, but they cleaned up their act, so now it's all
wheatgrass
and shite, and it's just like, I fucking love Billy Connolly so much, and he shows up with a crate of their old accoutrement, including plaster molds of all of their dicks, and he puts two of them on his head and just starts running around like he's a boar. Like, it's just fun to watch these guys hang out with each other, even when they're at each other's throats. I think that's really great.
And then watching them, the few moments that the magic works and you see why they were a successful band. And the way the finale of this movie is so heartfelt and so emotionally powerful. It's such a great moment. And when you watch them win over the crowd with that, like all of a sudden you're like, this is, because again, this is actually borrowing, you know, again, borrowing from rock history. Mm-hmm. This festival is based kind of loosely on the big one in Bohemian Rhapsody.
Live Aid.
Yeah, where, you know, Queen at that point was, they were done. You know, people loved Queen, but they hadn't done anything successful in a while, and they were an older band, and, you know, they were being handed their hat. And they had just done, you know, something the movie didn't fucking mention, by the way, which pissed me and Brian off to no end, was there were two big things left out of that fucking movie.
Yeah.
The Flash Gordon and Highlander.
How do you not just mention, even just a fucking line that's like, oh, that's when we were off doing scores for movies, or some fucking acknowledgement of the fact that Queen did two of the greatest movie soundtracks of all time.
Yep.
Fuck?
I know. But so it's very much a Live Aid moment where you see all these people going, oh, yeah. Oh, God. No, I love these guys. I love this song. Holy shit. It's kind of like that moment from last week at the very end of Goldmine when someone puts a quarter in the jukebox and plays an old Slade song and an old Brian Slade song. And somebody goes, oh, I love this song.
Yeah.
You know, it's that reconnection of, oh, shit, there's the echo. This is where we've left a legacy. And watching them win over that crowd and that crowd like fall in love with them all over again is such a great moment.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when it threatens to storm again.
Oh, man.
And then, you know,
Karen's like, don't you dare.
Don't you dare. Like swearing at God, going, don't you dare ruin this. Yeah. And it doesn't. And it's great. And it's just, I love this movie so hard.
And one of the things I really love about how they play these characters is that once they've all gone their separate ways, there is this inescapable draw to this life. Even though they are at odds with each other, even though they're playing the shittiest clubs, you know, in this bus together, fighting all the time, they are drawn to this life. Like, there's a great moment where the one actor we haven't mentioned in the movie so far is Jimmy Nail, who plays Les, the bass player.
Yeah.
Who is, by the way, an actual singer. Who has a hit single in Ireland and the UK, and he and Bill Nighy are doing their own vocals throughout this whole movie. But he has a moment where he's, you know, when he is found by Stephen Ray's character. He is roofing an old church. He started a roofing business. And they just keep mentioning, he keeps telling him, like, I can't do this. I worked so hard to build this roofing business, and I built this business from scratch. There's no way I'm going back on the road. I worked so hard for this business. His wife says to him, you know, we've built this business up. And he finally says, yeah, I worked hard to build it up, but I hate it.
Yeah.
I hate it so much. And it's just like that thing where it's like, he did the right thing to do right by his family and make himself a success, but that's not where his heart is. And it's a very Scorpion and the Toad thing where it's like, I'm still a musician. That's never going to change. And he is just, and it's every one of these band members gets a little moment like that where you realize that despite all of their faults, despite a lot of them being completely dysfunctional, there is something about making music together that completes and defines all of them in a really legitimately beautiful way. And just watching those moments unfold in the midst of all this hilarious chaos is what balances out the movie. It's not slapstick and silly for silly's sake, nor is it, you know, overly saccharine. It finds the exact right balance to be what I think is a really great movie.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, totally concur. Oddly enough, another person we haven't mentioned yet, Frances Barber.
Yes.
She shows up in this super small role, but a hilarious through line in which she is this woman who's following Bino. And of course, we assume this is somebody trying to serve Bino papers.
Right.
And it turns out it's a woman who grew up in love with him. And now that she's heard the band is back together, is trying to have sex with the guy that she spent her whole life pining to have sex for. And so
yeah.
Bino gets his big win because he finally has a groupie again.
She corners him and he's like, he thought she was with the revenue service. And then she's like, you know, I fell in love with you guys as a band. My parents wouldn't let me listen to rock music. Yours was the only rock show I ever went to. And he's like, oh, okay. So what do you want? Cause she's been chasing him throughout this movie. He's like, so what do you want? And he goes, she says violent sex right now. And he's just like, okay, sure. Let's go with that. So you're not from the revenue service.
Yeah.
Such a great moment. Like they all get those moments. And like I said, that when they're in that tiny hall and, you know, Bill Nye is just trying to crank the music up and crank it up to the point that literally Wes's amp explodes and Bill Nye doesn't even notice because he's in this weird goth rock fantasy where he's started to see the stadiums that they used to play and not this tiny music hall in Holland where people, these fucking skinheads who are there, you know, waiting for their heavy metal band to start playing, are just fucking booing and saying, like, he doesn't care. All he sees, and they impose it on the screen, it's really interesting, is the stadiums that they used to play. And he is just trying to, at first you think he's delusional, and then you realize he's just trying to fucking keep it together. Like, remembering those days and remembering his former glory is how he's coping with the fact that there's a part of him that thinks he doesn't have it anymore. And it's, again, it's a really beautiful moment packaged in comedy. And I think when you're able to do both of those things well is when you really function as a film.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just a lot of fun to watch them. There's a great scene where Stephen Ray has been carrying around Jimi Hendrix's tooth.
Oh, yes.
On a necklace. And it's like,
it's his only thing of value.
It's the only thing of value that he owns. And then he goes to give it to Karen and manages to somehow knock the tooth off of the necklace. And they're searching in the snow for this tooth. And then, of course, a snowplow comes by and he's like, you're ruining rock history. There's just a lot of great moments like that throughout the course of the movie. And by the way, we mentioned last week the supergroup that was put together to come up with the music for Velvet Goldmine. There's something of a supergroup going on with this movie, too.
Yes. Yes, there is.
Fuck me running. The guys who came together to make the music for Still Crazy include Mick Jones from Foreigner, Jeff Lynne from Electric Light Orchestra, which is a band that I will defend until the day I die.
Oh, me too. We're big ELO fans here.
Hell yeah.
At Junk Food HQ.
Don't try to bring me down, Bruce, because that is a great fucking band. And then also, I'm trying to remember his name, the guy from Squeeze actually contributed a lot of music to this as well. Chris Difford of Squeeze. So you have Chris Difford of Squeeze, you have a guy from Foreigner and a guy from ELO. Like, that to me is a fucking supergroup.
It is. No, it absolutely is. And that song that they write that's kind of the through line of the movie, The Flame Still Burns,
yes,
is legitimately good fucking song. In fact, I think it actually, like, came back and charted a couple years later.
That would not surprise me at all. It's a fantastic... I mean, all the songs in this are fantastic. I mean, between this and Velvet Goldmine, take all the songs from those soundtracks, put them on one playlist, and that's a fucking great Saturday start
those
to
are,
finish.
They're two of my favorite fictional music movies, and those soundtracks are legitimately great soundtracks. In fact, if you really want to create a great playlist...
I mean, you really want to create a great playlist.
I mean, you throw on the Almost Famous soundtrack on with the... God, what's the band called in Almost Famous?
I keep wanting to say Penny Lane, but that's the name of the character.
No,
in the
movie. I keep thinking of Fever Dog, which is their song.
Right.
But yeah, so the band throw on the Almost Famous soundtrack and you get this fake early 70s rock collection that's amazing.
Yeah.
That is aping what came out at that time. And doing it so well, made by geniuses. But that's the weird thing about them is it's weird that we think about it that way. It's like, oh, these are fake songs. And no, it's not.
Stillwater.
Yeah. That's what it is. It's real music. We can appreciate it, but for some reason we don't. And just talking about that, Brian and I just had dinner in between recording. And we could not remember what the other movie I really wanted to do on Guys Who Rock. And now I've remembered. And now I'm really bitter that we decided not to do it. Yeah, we'll have to talk about it when we're off mic. But God damn it, I'm like, shit, I just now talking about that.
What are all these rubber bands doing here? Oh, it's because we're inside the baseball. That's why.
Right.
But yeah, I think this needs to be on your list. If you have a list of comedies about bands that include movies like This Is Spinal Tap, you really need to be watching Still Crazy as well. Like, there is such a wit in the dialogue and the way that these guys either are sniping at each other or are playing off each other that makes it feel like they have been a troupe together, a comedy troupe, for years. And it just, like, that is so much of it. There is a really great heart at the center of it and an amazing fucking soundtrack. Like I honestly don't know what else you could want from a music comedy like this.
Yeah, no, it's just a great feel-good movie, and it's one of those, it's perfect for any time of the night.
Like, yes.
It's perfect for your first A-list movie, because it's really going to play, but it's also great in the middle of the night when you just need some comfort film and you're winding down. It's just a really great, satisfying film.
And the story about, but let's go ahead and get to this, a bit of a spoiler alert here. When they find out that Brian isn't dead.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was kind of suspecting it might happen, but, like, the way that it comes about and how it affects things going forward is you expect that to be kind of played for goofy laughs, too. And then it turns out that when they find Brian, like, it's just the whole lifestyle has broken him to the point that he would rather be completely anonymous than ever be famous again.
He's clearly staying at a home.
Yeah.
He's clearly not well.
Yeah.
He's unstable and he's being taken care of. And he's just happy living a very normal, quiet life, trying to go day to day. And so the whole rock and roll thing is not going to go for him.
He's like Stallone at that monastery in First Blood Part 2, where it's just like a guy just wants to be left alone, but we're going to drag him back into the fray. And there's a really beautiful moment where he agrees to come back and do the music festival. It's the same gig where their last one was. And during the press conference, he just gets overwhelmed by the shittiness of some of the music journalists and decides he doesn't want to play.
Shitty journalists at a junket, Brian?
I've never heard of such
a thing. That is so weird.
Hey, Joss Whedon, will you leave a voicemail on my brother's voicemail for his birthday?
Go fuck yourself. That was not a round table. That was a junket where there were like 25 people in the room. It was basically a press conference. And that's what she asked. And I'm like, I'm going to throw shit at you. Like, I've only been in this business for a year and a half.
Why are you leaving messages on phone?
And even I know that I feel like that rant, that angry voice in my head was justified.
Absolutely.
Like, are you fucking nuts with this? It's like, and I'm the baby in the room who doesn't know shit from Shinola, and even I know not to ask that question, goddammit. Yeah,
junkets are not fun.
Well, there's a reason this isn't junket food cinema.
Here's a interesting little side thing. I've been to the Druid Circle.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I actually went there. A good friend of mine, Paul Cornell, took me to, because he's a big history buff, and whenever we go out to the UK, we usually swing into where he lives. His wife is a vicar and runs the church in this wonderful, delightful small town.
Can you just say that about people on the air? Like, that seems really private.
Oh, she's a vicar.
Whoa. Okay. All right.
Whoa. No.
Your words, man. Allegedly.
Allegedly. Yeah, we're just going to become a Letterkenny podcast.
I am totally fine. And it's called Figure It Out. Don't think I haven't considered...
Fit or better, let's get at her.
Don't think I haven't considered starting a Letterkenny podcast devoted solely to that show.
Yeah, that is a possibility. I don't have time, but I might squeeze it in. So he's a big history buff, and so every time we go to a different part of that part of UK and just get to see something. And that the Druid Circle in this movie is an actual big, this small town that has these 3,000-year-old fucking stones in it going around in concentric circles. And there's that spot that they're standing at where you can see the inn that they then go into. And of course, that's actually not the same inn, but like that where they shot the inside, the interiors are not the same as the exterior. But I've been out there. And in fact, when I was there, I was like, Jess, she's like, what? I'm like, I know this place. And she's like, she thought I was doing a bit. And I'm like, this is the stone circle from Still Crazy. And she's like, what? Oh my God, where all the sheep come over and I'm like, yeah. And she's like, oh my God, it is. Holy shit. So we were like geeking out that we had found ourselves to the one of the sets of one of our favorite movies. Cause we've watched this a lot. In fact, I went to rewatch it this weekend and I was like, hey, you want to watch movies with me? I've got to watch stuff for junk food. And like, what is it? And I'm like, Still Crazy. And she goes, I've seen that movie a lot. And I'm like, I know you love it. Yes, I love it, but I want to watch something new tonight. So I was like, all right, well, I'll just watch this separately. But
so let me load up 3 Jeff Speakman movies for you.
Oh, did he make 3?
I went back and watched another one that he made called Street Night recently. And what was... Sidebar. He drinks a whiskey drink. He drinks a vodka drink. He drinks a lager drink. He drinks a cider drink. What was interesting about...
Yeah. You think the Jeff Speakman conversation is still crazy?
Bloody sidebar. What was interesting is that what we talked about in Perfect Weapon, about how it's a very imperfect film, however, the villain cast is so robust and so great, was what was missing from Street Night, is that it needed a Michael Ironside, or it needed a...
Baldwin?
No, it needed an Alec Baldwin.
No. Like Mercury Rising Alec Baldwin.
No, this is... You know what? You know what? That's not a bad Alec Baldwin. That could have worked. Although I don't feel like we would ever have gotten Alec Baldwin in this movie. But actually, the guy I was thinking of was William Sadler. I said it needs either a Michael Ironside or a William Sadler. And guess who started following us on Twitter when I said that? William Sadler. It was awesome.
Who doesn't love William Sadler?
Dude, you gotta. But that's what it, when the best actor in your movie is Jeff Speakman, there's a problem. There's a big fucking problem.
When you've got an actor in your movie named Jeff Speakman, there's a problem.
If you have an actor in your movie named Jeff Speakman, you might be a bad film. We're not going to start the blue collar junk food cinema tour.
That's not the Joe Bob Briggs blue collar cinema tour.
If you're using Snaps, I've Got the Power, not once, but twice, you might be the perfect weapon. If you have an actor in your movie who looks like Odd Job, so someone on Twitter says, I love that movie because Odd Job's in it, but Odd Job is definitely not in it, you might be the perfect weapon.
I was wondering, once you started on the perfect weapon, I'm like, he's still sore about that. He's still sore about someone thinking Odd Job's in that movie. Odd Job was dead before they made that movie, but like for 10 years in the ground before they made that movie.
If you're one Pat Morita short of the Asian All-Stars as playing your villains, you might be the perfect weapon.
I love that movie. It's got Hervé in it.
No, that's Mariska Hargitay. They're often confused for one. If you have Mariska Hargitay, but she doesn't say a word, you might be the perfect weapon.
God.
All right. Day. I will do this all fucking
Where
day.
Where was this joke? 3 episodes ago.
I don't know. I was busy making...
4 episodes ago. This was a month ago at this point.
Apparently, I was busy making Sinister 2 jokes that you were just sharpening knives over.
Mariska Hargitay.
Stargrove. I
love Guru.
Anyway, guys, the point is, Still Crazy, as we are, as we have been over 6 seasons now of Junk Food Cinema, Still Crazy is a phenomenal fucking film. It's a great, great musical comedy with, as we said, legitimately awesome soundtrack.
and a legitimately awesome cast.
Like, yes.
Just if you have never seen this, if you've gone this whole time and gone, well, I don't need to watch it now. Fuck yes, you do.
You do.
But you're missing a Bill Nye, Timothy Spall movie in your life, and everybody needs more of those.
You don't, like, you don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be that guy. That's all I'm going to say. And that brings us to the junk food pairing. I'm going to throw one out there, and I'm going to see what you think. If you like it, you can keep it. If you don't, throw it right back. I'm going to go with fruit stripe gum, because fruit stripe gum is a strange fruit gum for one reason and one reason only. It is the most delicious, flavorful gum you will ever have for about 4.5 seconds. And then the flavor immediately disappears, to the point that the only way to really enjoy fruit stripe gum is to eat about 6 pieces back to back and spit it out after about 4 seconds, which exemplifies the old rock and roll adage that it is better to burn out than fade away. So this strange fruit stripe gum also adheres to the rock adage of burning out and not fading away. So I'm going to go with fruit stripe gum. You got something?
I mean, the only other thing would be to suggest eating fruit, which is kind of the antithesis of junk food cinema.
This was my dilemma in coming up with something.
I do enjoy fruit, but I mean, you know what? Here's what I would do. I would suggest a nice slice of fruit of the forest pie.
What is fruit of the forest pie? Is that another Gandalf reference I don't know about?
No, this is a type of pie that people are not hugely aware of. I'm a huge fan of it. Fruit of the forest pie is a berry pie with a mixture of berries, generally raspberries, blackberries, blueberries, but also rhubarb. And the rhubarb adds a nice tang to what is already a tangy pie, and is a delicious pie. Jim's used to serve it for years. And then one day in 1998, decided to stop carrying fruit of the forest pie, because it turns out there was only one asshole going around to all of the gyms saying, "Do you have fruit of the forest pie today?" No, he'd have to heat one up. All right, well, I'll take a whole pie and I'll wait for it. I would actually have them bake me the pie fresh, because Old Man Cargill, we've already sang the song. Back in the 90s, Jim's charged $8 for a whole pie.
That ain't bad.
So it was $2.25 for a slice of pie, $8 for a whole pie. And so I was like, well, shit, I'll take a fresh piece of pie and take the rest home. So they're like, well, it'll take 45 minutes. Well, I'll have a cup of coffee to go with it then. So I'd sit and have a cup of coffee with friends, and then it would bring me out a pie, and they'd slice me off a piece, and I'd get it a la mode, and it'd be fucking awesome. And then people would be like, did you just order a whole pie? And I was like, fuck yes, I did. But yeah, you can find great recipes online for fruit of the forest pie. I've made it. It's pretty much as good as Jim's used to make, but it's a good strange fruit pie.
If going to the gym means that you order a whole pie and sit there for 45 minutes and that's the closest you get to going to an actual gym, you might be junk food cinema.
You might be junk food cinema.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us on this discussion of Still Crazy, which I...
Wait, hold on. I just got a cease and desist from Jeff Foxworthy.
God damn it! How did he find us? I thought he would be so busy with his nothing, with his residual checks from Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Damn it, how did he find the time?
Because we aren't.
No, that's right. You know what? Fair play. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. I am really happy that we got to cover Still Crazy. Thank you, Cargill, for recommending this movie. I really, really enjoyed it. And we will be back next week with another Guys Who Rock title that we're super excited about, but I'm not going to name in case we pull an audible. So I'm going to leave us that little window. So Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massworm. That's MASSAWYRM. And you can find my other podcast with Dave Chen on writing advice called Write Along with Dave and Cargill.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Bryguy Salisbury or at Junk Food Cinema. And you can also, the weekend of April 12th through the 14th, find Junk Food Cinema.
Fuck yeah.
At the Chattanooga Film Fest.
Eating as much Chattanooga fried chicken as we can. Drinking Chattanooga whiskey.
Really just trying to work the word Chattanooga into everything, because it's a fun word to say.
Yeah, you are going to eat yourself into a food coma and then wake up and wash it down with whiskey made right there in Chattanooga, and then watch films and meet Joe Bob Briggs. And it's probably going to be the most junk food cinema weekend of all time.
And that sound you hear is this table almost getting knocked over from the erection I just got from that thought. I am super excited for it. And hey, if you like talk about our erections, you can go to patreon.com.
And who, if you really like hearing us talk about our erections.
If you like guys talking about pies and erections, you might be a listener of Junk Food Cinema. And as such, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And for as little as $1 an episode, you get access to bonus content that no one else should hear. I'm sorry, that no one else gets to hear.
You get photos of things that apparently no one else should see.
There is no $50 tier.
You get images you cannot scrub out of your head.
In the $50 tier, there's an exchange of photos. Just keep that in mind when you don't sign up for it. Anyway, guys, I just
that the erection of Megaforce tier?
The erection of Megaforce tier is how we're going to end this episode.
Megaforce.